Good evening. So again, many of you have been sitting all day, walking, eating, thinking. Trying to stop thinking. And so we find ourselves, with the issue at hand. What is this life for I spoke about last night? And whether you know it or not, those of you who have been sitting the last few days, is that you're learning so much about not only what this life is for, but what this human experience is like. And so you've learned a lot of things, maybe that you already knew, but you're knowing things in a much deeper way now. You're really knowing what it's like to breathe. You're really knowing what it's like to be in this body. Some of you I know from the interviews are starting to access or starting to learn how to access this heart through forgiveness, through metta, through loving kindness, kind friendliness. And so maybe we're starting to see that there's actually a whole other world inside of our experience that we have not noticed previously. The world of internal mindfulness, we call it. What is it like in here, really? What is it like to be inside of your experience? And we're so fortunate, I feel like we're so fortunate that we have this, as I spoke about last night, we have this map, this Dharma map, to point out some things. The Buddha very generously points out some things to notice. Notice some things. Watch out for this, watch out for that. He guides us down this path of awakening. And like with every path, we stray. We fall off, we get confused, we get lost, and then we get back on, and we get off, we get back on. And that's okay, that's really how it is actually, isn't it? So tonight I'm going to speak in detail about what is called the second noble truth. The first noble truth, the reality of stress and pain and suffering. The reality of birth, old age, sickness, and death. The reality of not getting what you want, sometimes getting what you don't. The reality of dissatisfaction. And we all know this experience. And so one of my favorite teachers, Joseph Goldstein, was one time asked if he could sum up the Buddha's teachings in just one sentence. Now, what did he really teach? What is the aim of the practice if you could describe it in one sentence? And he said, the whole of the Dharma is liberation through non-clinging. And it's this practice of liberating ourselves by not clinging. The Pali word, or the way that the Buddha talks about how we create suffering for ourselves, is this word tanha, which means craving. It's usually translated as craving. To me, tanha translates really well to actually just mean addiction. I believe that the Dharma is the oldest addiction treatment program on the planet. And if practiced, will lead to not only the end of certain types of addiction, but will lead to the end of all addiction and will lead us to a place of happiness, true happiness and well-being, if we can put these practices into place. So we see that there's this inevitable sense, there's this low-grade sense of dissatisfaction and pain and discomfort, unpleasantness in life, dukkha. We know this, we see this, we all have this. And because we have a body, because we have a pain body, What arises out of dukkha, what arises out of this First Noble Truth is this experience of tanha, this experience of craving. And because there's pleasant feelings, we all have pleasant feelings, a wide range of pleasant feelings. Because we have pleasant feelings, we cling to pleasant feelings. We like them, we want to take them hostage, we want that. We cling to that, we need that, we become addicted to that. And because we have pain, we have painful feelings, and we want to get rid of those, all of them, the whole lot. And so this dukkha is really something that's in the body, it's in the natural world, it's the result of being human. It's how it is. It's really not much. It's like gravity, right? It's like you can disagree with gravity, but it's still going to knock you down. Dukkha, same thing. It's like gravity. And what arises out of this dukkha, what arises out of this pain body, which I believe is really a direct result of our nervous system, is we're very sensitive. Have you noticed how sensitive you are? Physically sensitive. Emotionally sensitive, mentally sensitive, we get our feelings hurt, people say mean things to us, we're sensitive. And because we have this sensitive nervous system, we have this tanha, we have this craving. And so what mindfulness does, what we start to learn how to do, is we start to unpack some of this stuff. We start to see the difficulty. We start to see the reality of dukkha. And we start to see we react to it. So we could maybe say craving is reactivity. Physical reactivity, emotional reactivity, mental reactivity. It gets us going. What starts off as a slight irritation or agitation, tanha gets us going into this reactivity. And so what did the Buddha awaken to? What he saw clearly from his direct experience was that this was the beginning of how we create suffering for ourselves, is that when we come into this nervous system body and we crave for pleasure and we crave to get rid of pain, we cling to pleasure and we hate pain, that when we start to get pulled into that process, is that what pulls us into mental suffering? This is what pulls us into suffering about the pain, about the discomfort, about the dukkha. We suffer about it. And so the Four Noble Truths are these are not just like, again, this isn't just the Buddha's dogma. This is a pragmatic thing. You can see this. You've probably seen this many times today. In your own experience, you're sitting here, it's unpleasant, there's pain, and then you start to get reactive around it, you start to get pulled into it. And so the Buddha, bringing mindfulness inward, bringing mindfulness into direct experience, saw that, oh, this is how humans create suffering, this is how I create suffering for myself. In short, it's just this reaching for pleasure, pushing away pain, reaching for pleasure, pushing away pain. And this is not our fault. This is not like in Christianity what they call sin. This is not our fault. This is not good, bad, otherwise. This is just reality. This is just the result of having a nervous system body. We can't but help do it. So we don't want to add to the suffering by creating a story about I should or shouldn't do this. This is why, as somebody who's struggled with drug addiction most of my life, and I work with people who are drug addicts, is that what happens to people with drug addiction, if you've been through it, is there what carries with it often is this low-grade sense of that I'm like a bad person, and that's why I do this, that there's something wrong with me, I'm broken, I'm diseased, I'm fucked up, and that makes the suffering actually even worse. So the self, again, gets pulled into that, and we create a story, we create a narrative around that. And so craving isn't our fault. It's not something we need to feel bad or guilty or ashamed about. It's just something that we need to start to notice and to start to bring mindfulness to and start to consider the ways in which we might be able to let go, we might be able to live with less, we might be able to change our lifestyle around a little bit so we're not ruled by this. So this doesn't rule our thoughts, it doesn't rule our actions, it doesn't rule our speech and our behavior. And this is what, this is against the stream. This is going against what is our natural tendency. I find it easy to do a forgiveness practice when I see it this way. I'm like, oh, of course I do this. Of course I hate pain. Of course I, you know, create suffering for myself because of this thing. It's totally not my fault. So I was talking last night about my story, and as I'll continue with parts of my story and parts of the Buddha story to try to tie all this together in a way that's maybe easy to follow, hopefully, for you. It's as much as I was awoken to this First Noble Truth, was able to see the tragedy and the loss that I'd been through and the death, and some degree of acceptance around that, some degree around, okay, this isn't my fault, this is how it is for many people. Bringing some mindfulness, having some mindfulness practice, and having a little bit of ease around the experience. It didn't change my behavior. It didn't change a lot in terms of what I did in the future. It changed a lot in how I viewed the past and how I viewed what happened. But as I went out into the world and I started to study the Dharma, and a lot of times the translation is that desire is the cause of suffering, which is a bad translation. And I would say, well, I don't see how that's true. I don't see how desire causes suffering, or even this idea of craving causes suffering. My mind said, not that craving didn't cause suffering, but getting that the goal of life was to get what you want, to get the pleasure. Not satisfying the craving is the problem, is what I thought. And so I started to kind of lose the practice in my early 20s. And I also had this very strong sense that the world owed me something. I felt some degree of entitlement. I also felt some degree that I kind of had something to prove. I had this feeling that I had something to prove to the world, because not only did I have this difficult time growing up, but also I had a really bad speech impediment when I was young, and kids were mean to me, and I was bullied and made fun of, and I really wanted to show everybody. And so I got very interested in playing music, and I started playing guitar and started playing in punk rock bands, and I ended up really actually having a fairly successful career playing in a ska punk band. And it all rolled into this kind of wanting to be a rock star, wanting to become something, also fueled with this low-grade anger, also fueled with this drug and alcohol use. And this idea, this delusion that if I could create this version of myself, if I could become something, that I would actually be happy. And so I put all of my energy and all of my effort into this becoming this thing, this person that would mean something in the world. And so to some extent what I was doing, and I think many of us do, is we postpone our happiness and we postpone our well-being, and we place our happiness and our well-being on some future expectation of how we hope things are. And we say things like, oh, I'll be happy when. My life will have meaning when. I'll be able to make sense of this world when. And so that creates kind of a momentum of its own. And we kind of can fall asleep into that delusion. We can start to believe that, oh, actually, you know what, when I do get the right job, when I do get the right circumstances, when things are finally going to be going my way, then I'll be happy. And of course, that builds a belief system that clearly I'm not happy now. And so when the Buddha talks about this tanha, this craving, he talks about it in three specific kinds of ways. And the first way is really the most obvious. It's this craving for sense pleasure, which is the one that in everyday life we see so much. Craving for delicious food, craving for the perfect temperature, craving for good sights, sounds, tastes, smells. Just the sense realm craving. You know, I'll be happy when. I've been in Thailand for a little while now and I'm starting to miss the food back home and I'm having a little bit of delusion. I'll be so happy when I get to have a fish taco. And you know what? I will be happy when I have a fish taco, but it's not going to end all my woes. It's just going to be a fucking fish taco and it's going to be gone in 2 minutes. And so we get lost in this kind of craving, don't we? We just, oh, this will make me happy, this will make me happy, this will make me happy. We see this, of course, play out very much in addiction. It's a sense craving. Whether it's pills, marijuana, alcohol, food, sex, even gambling to some extent, is that we get these little hits of pleasure and we become addicted. We can't stop. The habit becomes so strong. So really, to some extent, a lot of addiction is a sense craving, clinging, habit addiction. That, for those of you who have been through, know it's very difficult to get, very difficult to break those chains. And so we crave for sensory pleasure. We crave for all of the joys and pleasures of the sense gates. And sometimes we do some strange and creative things to satisfy those cravings. The other thing that we crave for is the one I was speaking of, this idea of being a rock star, or this idea of I'm going to be happy when, is this what he calls, is this craving for existence or becoming. And so what happens is we get these ideas in our mind when we become something, when something is going to happen, I'm going to shift from this version of myself into another version of myself, and then I'm going to be happy, I'm going to be content, my life will have meaning. When I become a wife, when I become a husband, when I become a father, when I become a PhD, whatever, when I become this successful business person, when I become whatever it is that your current becoming is. I'm sure you all have one. Maybe you have a couple going. And so we want this sense of, it's almost an eternal sense. So from a religious perspective, it's this thing that we get fed of life after death and eternity and going to heaven and being with all your friends and loved ones, which is what's very much preached to us in America. The God delusion. Life after death, eternal happiness. I don't think it's going to happen. And so we become this, we get lost in this becoming something. I'm going to become something and I'm going to be happy. I'm going to become something and I'm going to be happy. And we crave and we get caught and we cling and we a lot of our mental energy goes into this and we miss out on all of the things that are happening right in front of us. And so the third kind of craving is really the opposite of that. It's craving for non-existence. This could be seen as suicidal ideation for some of us, just wanting this to be over in its most extreme form. It's also craving for this, not wanting to be, there's certain things about ourselves that we wish weren't true, right? I wish my past wasn't as troubling as it was. Sometimes I get upset that I don't want to tell the story again, and I feel like people are going to pity me, and so I don't want it to be like that. Or we're just not happy with who and what we think we are, so we crave and we want this to be gone. I don't want to be a drug addict. I don't want to have this toxic anxiety. I don't want to have this trauma. I don't want to have this suffering that I have. I hate it. I want it to go away. I crave for it to be gone. So there's a lot of those three, if you start to unpack them and see all of the ways they manifest in our experience, it's a lot. It's a lot. And again, not our fault. This is just how it works. This is how it works in our system. This is the psychology of Buddhism. And so the more we see this, actually, this is good to be able to see this. If you're understanding this and following this and seeing this in your experience, you're seeing things clearly, actually. This, often I call it the equation of human suffering. I can break it down for you in a very simple mathematical equation. And it's just the thought or the perspective, if only X, then Y. If only I was like this, then I would be happy. If only I wasn't like that, then I would be satisfied. And you have, I'm sure, many versions. You have all your own variables you can place in this equation. If only this were true, then I would be fulfilled. I would be satisfied. If only this were not true, then my life would have meaning. I would feel okay. And it's, to some extent, in its most basic form, it's this experience of just craving for other. In meditation, we see this so clearly. When you're just in this moment and you just, I want this moment to be different. I want my body to be different. I want my sensations in my legs to be different. I want to be in a different moment. This moment sucks. How do I get in a different moment? I'm in the wrong moment. I'm in the wrong building. I'm in the wrong country. I'm in the wrong body. And your mind will get into this becoming and say, you're right, this is the wrong moment. What the fuck did you get us in this moment for? You thought coming all the way to north of Thailand, being in the middle of nowhere, was going to make us happy? What were you thinking? Nice try, pal. And so we see this almost moment to moment, right? Craving, becoming, wanting things to be other than. And we suffer. It might just be a low-grade irritation. It might be just a mood swing, or it might not be that bad. But when it's bad, isn't it? And so we lose the ground. We lose the breath. We lose the body. We lose the practice. And we create suffering in the mind. One of the experiences I can tell you in great detail about how I came to see this Second Noble Truth in a way that was extremely heartbreaking and disappointing. There's a, who says it? Somebody said, be careful what you wish for because you just might get it. I think it might have been Ralph Emerson or one of those guys. And I learned that the hard way because I spent many years, I spent about 10 years of my life, you know, living very cheaply, selling drugs, playing in bands, and all of my mental intention, all of my faculties were dedicated to this band and this success and this, when I make it and I'm touring and I'm playing on stage in front of thousands of people and I arrive in that experience, I'm going to be happy and I'm going to be happy forever. It's going to be great. And I spent years and years and years trying to create that. And when it finally happened, when my band started to have success and we were playing in all these outdoor festivals, for those of you who are Europe, you know about the open air stages. Anybody from Belgium ever been to Pukkelpop Festival, right? Yeah. I played Pukkelpop. And so at first it was great. At first it was a lot of fun. I was drinking a lot. I was doing a lot of drugs. I was having lots of sex, and I was playing in front of lots of people. And it started to wear off. It started to turn on me. The drugs and the alcohol started to turn on me. And I remember playing at this festival in Holland, this big outdoor festival. There was maybe 25,000 people in the crowd. And I was drinking backstage. And at this point, I was starting to feel the self-hatred. I was drinking and doing drugs and doing things I didn't feel good about and feeling shame and just starting to feel like this whole thing wasn't working. This whole thing I'd spent years doing wasn't working. and really wanting to be in denial about that and go, no, it's working. Like, this better fucking work. I've invested so much time and energy into this. I was like, mindfulness, go away. Do not shine a light on this. Let me live in my delusion. And I remember just playing on a stage and playing my guitar and just standing there and just having this moment of like, this is totally unsatisfying. I am not happy. And I would get in this negotiation with my mind, say, no, this is good. And I was like, no, this isn't good. I don't know who any of these people are. I don't care about any of these people. They don't care about me. I'm drunk, they're drunk. I hate the guys in my band. I mostly hate myself. And it all kind of came flashing before me. And I was probably pretty inebriated at the time. I'm sure I was high and I'm sure I was drunk. But it was this breakthrough of wisdom. It was this, I'd done too much Dharma practice. One of my jokes is the Dharma ruined my life many times. And this was one of the times it really ruined my life because I really could see I've been craving and becoming, and I knew this teaching a little bit. I'm like, the Buddha talked about this. Like, you should have fucking done, known better. And shortly after that, I ended up quitting my band and quitting drinking and drugs and completely exiled from that experience. And at 28 years old, I went back to Massachusetts, where I'm from, to live back with my mom and dad at 28, because I had no money. I had a bag of stinky clothes and two crappy guitars and $40. And I was very disappointed. And actually, to me, even this is 12 years ago now. And even for me, I still actually feel some regret and some disappointment that actually didn't work for me. And since then, I'm also disappointed and a little embarrassed to report to you that I have likewise continued this strategy in various ways. When I got sober, I built a house and had a business, and I still find that this becoming thing is a huge part for me. That, you know, even this moment right here, it's like, okay, I'm gonna teach meditation, and I taught meditation in prisons, and you know, I'm gonna become a Dharma teacher, and maybe someday I'll teach retreats and I'll be totally happy when I'm in northern Thailand teaching a retreat for a bunch of people. And I mostly am happy, but still a little bit like, I thought it'd be better than this. But it's like fucking the Buddha again. And so this is part of, you know, this delusion and this greed and this hatred and this mind trickery. And that's why all this emphasis and all this talk about living in this present time, I don't like the word present moment so much, but just your life, our lives really do happen one moment at a time. It's just one moment after another, it's just one breath. And that's really, actually, really true. And when we take birth and when we get pulled up into this clinging, into this becoming, and into these stories, how we could tell ourselves how it's going to be better when, and if I could get rid of this, and if I could get rid of that, and if I was more like this, and if I was less like that, I would be happy, my life would have a meaning. And then how come you haven't done that yet? What's taking you so long? This craving always wants to, it has this urgency to it, doesn't it? It's immediate. Do it now, get it now, be it now. We live, and those of you who live in the modern world, in the Western world, especially in America, it's so, if you have to wait more than this long for what you want, it's like you're totally inconvenienced. You know? There's no patience, there's no presence. And so, you know, when we think about this idea of liberation through non-clinging, And we see, sometimes I can get depressed and I can get very down on myself because I see so much clinging in my mind. I see this becoming and I see this craving. I see it so much that I'm like, man, I am never, ever going to wake up. This force, this tendency is just way too strong. I can sometimes feel like not wanting to practice anymore. And we become really hard on ourselves in these moments, in these experiences. We start to really beat ourselves up. We start to experience the inner bully. You're not doing it right. You're not doing it fast enough. You make bad choices. Why do you make bad choices? You always make bad choices. It's interesting to me that the mind that told me to make the bad choice is the same mind that later on goes, "What the fuck were you thinking?" And I'm like, "Dude, I just did what you told me to do. I don't see why you always have to blame me for everything." And so what we're being asked to do is we're trying to cut through this with awareness. We're trying to sharpen this sword of mindfulness. So that way we can break through that. We can slice it. And one of the things that they do in Dharma circles and in Buddhism in general, that's a language thing that I find to be very unhelpful. So we say the practice is liberation through non-clinging. And a lot of times in Buddhism, when they want you to do the opposite of something, they just conveniently park the word non in front of it. Clinging is bad, it causes suffering. So what do I do then? Well, you non-cling. Well, how do I non-cling? I got the clinging part down. I see it, I accept it, I know it. I'm totally on board at this point. But how does one non-cling? And so the way that I like to think about it, I learned from a teacher named Martine Batchelor, is this idea of how do we actually creatively engage? Or how do we enter the realm of clinging, and how do we approach it in the mind with some degree of curiosity, some interest, some kindness. Okay, I know that I do this. I see that I do this. Okay, if this is happening, how can I relate to it now? How can I creatively engage? How can I have a relationship to this clinging process in a way that feels manageable and doable? And to the point where I'm actually even interested in it. Because it's like we hear non-clinging, okay, got it, clinging's bad, don't cling. And it's like we want to just chop it off. But it's like you can't just chop it off. You can't switch it off. It's unswitch-offable. And so now we're just clinging to get rid of clinging. And so when we think about creative engagement, when we think about mindfulness and we think about curiosity, we think about, okay, all right, can I notice the process more of when I'm clinging? And so to kind of maybe walk you through it step by step, I think there's really five moments that we can capture, or there's five experiences that we can start to notice when we're getting pulled into craving. We're getting pulled into this becoming something or not becoming, or just the sense pleasure. So we can see that it happens in stages. It's not just one moment we're not clinging and then the next moment we're fully clinging. There's a bunch of events, there's little mind moments that happen, right? And so if we can track these experiences, we can maybe create kind of an intervention. And so the first thing that happens, and sometimes I'll use the bell as a way to try to portray this, is the first thing that happens is we become identified with something. We notice something pulls us in. We notice the sound of a bell, for example. The ears hear it, they go towards it. We identify that it's a bell. We know that it's a bell. And so just like we identify that external sound, we might identify a thought and it pulls us in. We might think. And so as we become identified by things, it starts to become solidified. It starts to take form in the ways of concepts and ideas. So as much as this is just a sound, your mind goes bell. We know it's a bell. And we might think, I kind of like that bell. I wonder where they got that bell. Maybe I should get a bell. Maybe I'd meditate more if I had a bell. I like it. And so now what happens is we become identified with this experience and we start to solidify. It becomes an idea. It starts to have a hold on us. It's got our attention now, right? The bell has got your attention. You know it's a bell. It's pulled you in. I like the sound of that bell. I wonder where they got it. Maybe I'll ask Julian where he got it. I should get one. I'll meditate more if I have one. Maybe I'll get a whole bunch of them and send them back home for everybody because they're probably cheaper in Thailand. You know, and I get pulled into it. And what happens is once we start to become solidified around these things, is it starts to become magnified. Right? And so when we get pulled into the experience of the bell or the I'm going to be a teacher or I'm going to go back to where I'm from and meet the right person and have a family or whatever the identification, it starts to become magnified. And when it starts to become magnified, all of our attention and all of our mental faculties kind of race towards that. And we kind of create this imaginary world of what that's going to be like when that happens. And what happens is because we become magnified and we become pulled into that, everything else now is gone. Right? We don't notice the room. We don't notice the building. We don't notice the breath. We don't notice the simple things that we were trying to notice before. We become magnified. In whatever it is, it could be any idea, any becoming thing. For me, it's like, you know, I could think about, okay, when I go back to LA, I'm definitely going to get some fish tacos because I like fish tacos. I think I'm going to go to that place in Silver Lake because they make the really good ones. They got the nice, delicious cream sauce that I like so much. And they don't put too much cabbage on them. They put a lot of avocado when I get back there. And then it's just like now I'm like eating a fish taco in Los Angeles. But I'm actually not doing that. Right? It becomes magnified, and now this other moment that's going to be me having a fish taco in Los Angeles or whatever it might be, now all of a sudden, this experience, this isn't so good. I want that. You know, and so we become pulled into this, and we become magnified. And so this magnification process, what happens is the next thing that it turns into is we start to proliferate, we start to think about it. You know, we start to think about it's going to be good, it's going to be like this. You know, I don't have an apartment yet, and so, you know, I'm like, well, I'm going to get, where in Los Angeles am I going to get an apartment? When I get an apartment, I'll make sure it doesn't have carpet because I don't like carpet. I'm going to make sure I have hardwoods, and I'm going to get some stuff from the store that I like. I'm going to get one of those cool vintage chairs that I like, and it's like, and I start to proliferate, mental proliferation, or just thinking about or becoming in the world of imagination. And not that this is bad or wrong or we shouldn't do this, but you know, at what point do we get so pulled into this proliferation process that all of a sudden we've created this other reality that would be better than the one that I'm, this isn't so good. This moment is lacking. This, my life is, I want this. Right? And where the suffering starts to really, really get us is in the final stages of when the proliferation starts to happen. What I notice happens is the story starts to become exaggerated. We start to think, oh, it's going to be so good. We start to exaggerate it. We start to become very delusional. We start to think, oh, it's going to be the best thing ever. It's going to be the greatest thing in the universe when that happens. You know? I'm going to be so fucking happy when I get those fish tacos. It's going to be great. All my troubles are going to be gone. I'm not going to have any more pain in my body. My heart is going to be free. And we create this, like, fairy tale about how much better your life would be in this world that took you 30 seconds to create. Because this process from identifying to solidifying to magnifying to getting caught up in the proliferation about it and the exaggeration about it takes about that long. The mind does it quick, doesn't it? And at some point we start to suffer. We come back into this experience, we come back into reality. And we're like, man, this is fucking no good. I'm not happy. And we start to think of all the reasons why we're not happy. We start to think of all the reasons why things haven't gone the way they were supposed to. And then we start to plead this case against ourselves of why it's your fault. And so, you know, what do we do? What do we, you know, how can we, you know, we think about this in a humorous way sometimes. It makes it more manageable because we know this. You laugh because you know what I mean. You know this experience. And so the Buddha saw this very clearly. It's rooted in this tanha, this wanting other. Wanting this to be gone, wanting this to be better. And we can draw it all the way back. We can draw the story all the way back into, gee, this moment is just a little tough for me right now. This retreat isn't going as well as I thought it was going to. I'm having a hard time. I'm having some emotions I didn't think that I was going to have. And we come back to that dukkha. And we see that the craving actually arose out of that dukkha, out of that inability to be with what was difficult. We created another reality. We created another life to be in. And blame ourselves for not being in it. Because my knee hurt. Or because whatever story, whatever hooked you in, whatever identification, whatever it was that came down and swept your attention out of the breath and out of the body and into this mental proliferation of the mind, into this world of imagination, and created this whole other experience that could be happening that would be so much better than the one that you're in. And why the fuck are you not there? And so we have to learn, you know, so we see where when we see that we are captured in the mind, when we see the attention, when we see that we become pulled into this process, we can just kind of go, okay, wait a minute here. Because the delusion of craving, the delusion of clinging, promises you things and it will never deliver. How many times have you had the thought, I'll be happy when? And when happens? And you go, not really. And then you start out, oh, but I'll be happy when. We know it doesn't work. We see that we do this to ourselves. And so, you know, how can we bring mindfulness to it? How can we bring awareness to it? Rather than the attitude, okay, craving, clinging, wrong, create suffering, switch it off. That's just craving. That's just now this other side of craving for non-existent. I just want that part of my experience to go away. But how do we go into it? How do we let ourselves go into it? See ourselves go into it with some curiosity, some interest, and some kindness, and some attention. Say, okay, yeah, how do I create suffering for myself? What stories do we tell ourselves? What's the theme? I'm sure you all have a theme. And so to reel this back again, to bring this back into the issue at hand, and this confusion that really got me early on in my practice was, we need to make a very clear distinction between desire and craving. From a Buddhist perspective, desire is ethically neutral. Desire is not good, bad, or otherwise. Desire is just part of being human. It's there. Ajahn Amaro, who's a famous Theravadan monk who lives in England, said that desire is the natural energy of this realm. That desire is just the whole motivation behind all of the human energy and all of the activities that we do. And we don't want to shame it or create a negative story. Desire is outlined in the Buddhist teachings of Buddhist psychology and the Abhidharma as an occasional, ethically neutral mental factor. Kind of a dry term. But it just means that desire occasionally arises. And it has no ethic to it. Desire is just a natural energy. It's when the desire is rooted in greed, hatred, and delusion that it becomes polluted, it becomes poisoned, and craving usually will arise on top of it. So we want our desires to be rooted in mindfulness, in forgiveness, in generosity, in these qualities. In the way that I've noticed, the way that desire works is that oftentimes we think desire turns into craving, and that desire might be a low-grade form of craving, but they're actually understood to be two very different things. And so really what we want to do is we want to nurture, we want to turn towards, and we want to really actually live from our actual wholesome desires, our desires to be happy, like we did in the metta practice today. May I be happy, may I be at ease. Desire. And one thing that I've noticed very clearly in my years of practice is that when my desire becomes polluted or when it becomes hijacked by craving is when my desire isn't being met. Maybe I'm longing for connection in my life. Maybe I'm feeling lonely and I'm longing to have somebody in my life to be with me or to have a romantic or a deeper connection in some way. And so there's nothing wrong with that. That's a good desire. That's fine. That's natural. That's part of being human. But when I'm unable to, when that desire doesn't get met in a fashion that I feel is appropriate, craving comes in and says, okay, like, don't worry about it. You don't have to feel vulnerable or lonely. Just eat this. Just go into this story. Just distract yourself from the discomfort, from the vulnerability, from the sadness, from the rawness of the desire not being met. Craving and addiction comes in and distracts us. It says, you don't have to feel that. Go have some fish tacos. Go to a movie. Have a drink. Make some plans. Update your Facebook. You don't have to feel this uncomfortable desire not being met business. Just distract. And so what happens is we have to learn. We have to begin to feel into this, what our deeper desires are. If my desire is happiness, if my desire is to be at ease in this world, I need to look at my behaviors and I need to look at my actions and say, are my actions and my speech and my behaviors in line with what my desire is? And oftentimes we'll find that they're not. And this is why so much emphasis in Buddhism is on ethics, on what we call sila, on this intention to not cause harm, this intention to be generous, to be aware, to be mindful. It's because when I am sitting in unmet desires, which I am more often than I would like to admit, we haven't built up any, an addiction specialist named Gabor Mate, some of you might have heard of, I don't know if I say his name right, it might be Gabor Mate, he's a brilliant guy from Vancouver, talks about this. We have to learn this inner resilience to be with just the rawness of our human experience and this reality that sometimes, you know, like the Buddha saying, we don't always get what we want. Sometimes we have to live for a period of time, maybe months, maybe years, with a desire, a wish that we have that's perfectly wholesome and fine and well-intentioned, but maybe it doesn't get met in the time in the way that we would like, and we have to learn how to sit and how to be inside of that experience. And we don't like that. And craving comes in and says, hey, check it out. Like, I see you're having a hard time. I got a whole bunch of other ideas. I got a whole platter of distraction and unskillful behavior and things. Seeking distraction and money and sexuality and drugs and alcohol and seeking to avoid the discomfort of desire not being met in ways that we know, doing things that we know go against our best judgment. And so we go for the temporary hit, don't we? Fuck it, I just want to feel good. We go for it. And so the practice, this is where this sila, this ethics, this kindness and compassion, it asks us to take the stand and say, you know what? I'm going to go this other way. I'm actually going to see if I can sit in my vulnerability for a little while. I'm going to sit in the hurt and the sadness and the loss and whatever it is. Something's not being met. I have this wish for myself and it's not happening yet. It's not happening how I would like it to happen. People aren't doing what I would like them to do. My plans, my... In some extent, you know, sometimes, like for me, a lot of my dreams, a lot of my big hopes in life, you know, came crashing down in front of me. And I had to learn to sit with that. And so for me, mindfulness as a practice, mindfulness is ethical. Awareness is... Mindfulness is rooted in these qualities. And it's rooted in this sense of empathy, of really caring about what's hard for me. And so this is why so much emphasis in the Dharma and the Buddhist teachings and the Eightfold Path, he begins by asking us to have this right view, seeing things clearly. That we talked about last night, seeing dukkha, seeing the disappointment, seeing this clinging process, the identification, the magnification, the seeing these things, and then cultivating what he calls right intention, sama sankappa, which means like ethical intention. And if my intention is to be kind and my intention is to not cause myself harm, sometimes I have to bear and I have to sit through and I have to deal with some real vulnerability to create that non-harming because of that clinging and that craving and that addiction that says, no, just do this. Just do this thing that will feel better temporarily. And I fail more times than I would like to admit. But the good thing about the practice and the way that it unfolds over time is that, you know, when I fail, it's because I have, you know, one more mango and sticky rice than I should have had. Not smoking methamphetamine out of a light bulb like I used to do when I couldn't manage my experience. Drinking tons of beer and having sex with people that I didn't really want to have sex with and doing all these destructive behaviors. Now I have one too many fruit shakes, or I eat a little more ice cream than I should, or I watch maybe some more TV than I would like to have. And so what happens is the distractions and these things that we do, they become a little bit less destructive over time. And we start to see ourselves, what else can I let go of? Oh, I can let go of this now. I can let go of this now. I can let go of this now. And the thing that is so important for all of us. And the thing that is the most challenging, and the one thing that we really need to own to some extent, is we all know the current struggles that we're in. You all know, I know, the current thing that I'm trying to not do. I have awareness of it. And we have to find the effort and we have to find the willingness to let go of the current craving and the current distraction. Because if we can't let go of what's right in front of us, we're never going to see what's behind it. And then we let go of that. And what happens is, here goes my buddy. Uh-oh. We are never going to be able to see what's behind that. And so we stay stuck if we can't break the current addiction, whatever it is. I love that guy. Forgot all about him. Okay. He's having a hard time too, right? He's like, this guy again? I'm trying to get some sleep down here. And I hope that that makes sense, is that we come to places like this and we do things like this usually because there's some current struggle in our life. There's something that we're coming up against. And we have to work through the issue at hand. We have to learn to sit in whatever vulnerability that you're sitting in now, whatever desire it is that you have that's not being met. Learning to sit in that and to tolerate that and create some patience and some awareness around that. And some ease with that, right? Some metta with that, some kind friendliness with that. Oh, I can, like I said last night, oh, I'm okay with this now. This used to be torture. This used to be so much pain. This used to be so much grief, so much sadness. But actually, no, I can, I'm okay with this now. I can sit with this. And so this liberation through non-clinging is a process that we continue to engage in. And the more that we do it, the more we gain confidence, you know, as we let go of the more destructive things that we do. We heal, we feel better about ourselves, we feel more self-esteem, we have less regret. We have less regret because we're willing to overcome the current denial. And as we overcome and we face and work through the current denial, we have less regret later. And we start to live in this way, we start to go in this process, and we gain this, what I'll talk about tomorrow, is this third noble truth. We start to see, oh, there is this other way. Oh, this Dharma, these practices actually work. I don't sit here in front of you because I think Buddhism is interesting. I don't sit here because I like the teachings and they agree with me philosophically, which they happen to do, but I sit here before you because these things have made a tremendous difference in my life. Things are different than they were before. Things are different than they were last year. And so when we gain this ability, sometimes called faith or trust, I think of it as confidence. When we start to do something and live in a certain way where we feel this inner spiritual faculty of confidence, we don't hesitate. We keep going. We have an innate wisdom that says, no, we know. Go this way, do this. And then when we come into contact with that unmet desire, when life hands us its next bowl of shit that happens, right? The next thing that lets us down, we see, oh, I've been here before. I have tools for this now. And the fear falls away, and the doubt falls away, and the I'm not good enough falls away, and there's more space inside, there's a more willingness to go up against the things we don't want to face. And we start waking up, and this is called awakening. Awakening is not an event. We don't go from being asleep to awake, and then we're just awake now. We fall asleep and we wake up in each and every moment of our lives. And the more moments we spend awake, the more we know what that's like, and the more we trust that experience, and the more we say, oh, this is the better, this is the worthwhile. This is the good, do this. This is the direction, this is the path, this is the way I want to go. And what happens is our speech and our action and our behaviors and our livelihood and our work in the world, all of a sudden, the way that we behave and the way that we act in the world starts to actually become in line with the desires that we had in the first place. One of the teachings that I like of the Buddha is this irrigating the field. And so the Buddha speaks a lot in agriculture and cultivation, and that what we're trying to do with the self is we're trying to irrigate the field by giving it good water and planting good seeds and planting good vegetation and good conditions. And so this cultivation from within, we cultivate the inner life by feeding it good things and planting the right seeds and pulling the right weeds. And we start to see that we start to wake up. And when you start to wake up, you'll start to notice how much you like that. And it will encourage us to continue. So I offer this for your reflection. This is my experience, my words with these practices, and I ask you to just investigate them for yourself. So let's just sit quietly for a minute or so. And just breathing in, breathing out, feeling the pulse of life inside your body, and just acknowledging that this is it. This is your life. You've arrived. There's no other moment. There's no other place to be. For good, bad, or otherwise, this is it. And seeing if we all can just take what's freely offered in this moment. And to see if we can just step inside, if we can just really fully arrive completely. This is it. You made it. Thank you for your attention this evening, and may you all sleep well.